For a spirit whose sole purpose is to corrupt and imitate the church, telling an anti-church apart from the true church is not a walk in the park. But the anti-church can be distinguished from the church by a drive to make enemies out of people rather than make missions for people. But back up. Why would a church, of all things, want to make enemies out of people who are different or otherwise want different things? Two words. Rage sells. George Corley Wallace Jr. was an American politician who served as the 45th governor of Alabama for four terms. A member of the Democratic Party, he is remembered as a staunch segregationist and for his populist views. He sought the United States presidency four times, and unsuccessful every time. Wallace opposed desegregation. He supported policies of Jim Crow during the Civil Rights era. He declared in his 1963 inaugural address that he stood for segregation now, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever. Regarding the evolution of Congressman Wallace, Ta-Nehisi Coates wrote in a 2012 article in The Atlantic, quote, "Wallace was once a sensible politician who generally was seen as fair-minded by black leaders in Alabama, but he lost the gubernatorial election after being tarred by John Patterson as too friendly to black people." Wallace subsequently vowed to never be, please forgive my language here, out-niggered again, and thus began his long, dark march into history. "You know," Wallace said, "I try to talk about good roads and good schools and all these things that have been a part of my career, and nobody listened. And then I began talking about niggers, and they stomped the floor." End quote. There are many published reports about this particular Alabama governor, but there are three in particular that seem to bump into one another, and I have a problem with it. Stephen Levitsky and Daniel Ziblatt's 2018 work, How Democracies Die, states, quote, "Wallace's defiant segregationist stance vaulted him to national prominence, leading to surprisingly vigorous bids for the presidency in 68 and 72. Wallace engaged in what journalist Arthur Hadley called the old and honorable American tradition of hate the powerful. He was," Hadley wrote, "a master at exploiting plain old American rage. Wallace often encouraged violence and displayed a casual disregard for constitutional norms, declaring, there is one thing more powerful than the Constitution, that's the will of the people. What is a constitution anyway? They're the products of the people. The people are the first source of power, and the people can abolish a constitution if they want to," end quote. Wallace's message, which mixed racism with populist appeals to working-class white sense of victimhood and economic anger, helped make inroads into the Democrats' traditional blue-collar base. Polls showed that roughly 40% of Americans approved of Wallace and his third-party run in 1968, and in 1972 he shocked the establishment by emerging as a serious contender in the Democratic primaries, end quote. It was during his 72 run that Wallace was shot in an assassination attempt, and he was visited in a hospital by none other than his political contender, the legendary Shirley Chisholm. Based on a 2005 Washington Post article, Wallace asked her, quote, "What are your people going to say?" Chisholm said, "I know what they're going to say, but I wouldn't want what happened to you to happen to anyone." He cried and cried, Chisholm recalled, end quote. However, in an excerpt from Adam Serwer's The Cruelty is the Point, he writes, quote, "By 1984, however, Wallace's memory of his own actions had changed. It was not an antagonism toward black people, and that's what some people can't understand," Wallace explained to a reporter from PBS for the documentary Eyes on the Prize. Wallace continues, "White Southerners did not believe it was discrimination. They thought it was the best interest of both races. I love black people. I love white people. I love yellow people," Wallace said. "I'm a Christian and therefore I don't have any ill feeling toward anybody because of the race, because our black people are some of our finest citizens." In remarkable symmetry with Stephen's defense of treason and defense of slavery, Wallace recalled his defense of racial apartheid as resistance to tyranny, end quote. due in part to her visit to him in the hospital. Chisholm said that later, Wallace wound up becoming, quote, the man who helped get the votes on minimum wages for black women, end quote. Clearly, there was some kind of change of heart on the part of Wallace during his political career, but the problem that I have with these three publications is that they don't seem to thread a very clear journey as to what that change was. Coates' reporting indicates that Wallace knew his political stance was wrong. It's just that he found more benefit in being wrong. Based on Chisholm's recollection of her visit, clearly there was some guilt that Wallace was feeling. Guilt, not remorse, can only happen in the event of the unexpected, and is therefore an internal recognition of some kind of failure. Whether it means I meant to do this but I ended up doing that, or I achieved what I intended but it's not what I expected, both are admissions of a failure. The trouble that I have with these publications is when Serwer comes in. Serwer quotes Wallace saying things contradictory to his own speech and behavior presented in Coates' reporting. Wallace said that he wasn't a proponent of violence, but violence is exactly what his behavior and political rhetoric supported. Why would Wallace lie about something that he supported in an attempt to take power and eventually undermine constitutional power through will of the people? If this is now starting to sound familiar, it is because it comes from the modern strongman's playbook of fascist interference. But what most astounds me is actually Chisholm's encounter. It was after the assassination attempt that Chisholm seemed to witness some level of repentance in Wallace. Raised and indoctrinated in something so morally cancerous as fascism, for Wallace to pull a moral 180 from that direction and eventually recommit himself to genuine American democracy is something we would be remiss to glaze over and ignore in a time like today. Chisholm was a hero in many political ways, but I dare add she was a hero in a spiritual way. Her ability to show human compassion to Wallace in his worst time, as both the person himself and his physical condition, did have a credible impact on a fascist actor. Imagine what kind of change we could bring with that kind of compassion. It would impact more people at a rate faster than fascists can sell rage. Trumpism proves something. People do need an excuse or some kind of permission to bring out the worst of themselves. And what I had to realize is that compassion and humanity actually require the same kind of permission. Philanthropy is not natural. I wish it were, but it has to be nourished, encouraged, and praised, and honored. If not, people will naturally incline to their own needs, especially at the expense of their own neighbor. I also realize philanthropy, like rage, takes more than just money or some form of tangible benefit to continue to motivate people. It takes empowerment. Empowering the worst to be better. And empowering the better to be their best. Communities all over America have become so weary and tired, they have given up on self-improvement. Just get by. Paycheck to paycheck. Weekend to weekend. Job to job. Party to party. Campaign to campaign. People are in an autopilot survival mode. And it only takes one bad actor on social media to convince them violence, hatred, or bigotry is the answer. The fascist answer to everything is rage sells. But I am willing to bet love sells a lot more. Will you?